This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Fred Lynn just retired as chief public defender for Guilford County. When he joined the public defender's office back in the mid-70s, he thought he might stick around for a couple of years. Well, that turned into a 45-year career. Today on the State of Things, we'll talk with him about that career and about another career that almost was. It was basketball that brought him to North Carolina in the first place, played for Duke, and for a while had hopes of playing professionally, but the court of law won out, and we will talk to Fred Lynn all about that now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Grew up in suburban Chicago, right?
In Highland Park, a city about 25 miles north of Chicago. Moved out there when I was 4 years old with my parents and brother.
Tell us about growing up there.
Well, it was an interesting town. It was, when I moved out there, I think the population was maybe 25 or 30,000, and it was diverse in a religious way, not racial. I think it was about a third Jewish, a third Protestant or Christian, and a third Catholic.
Yeah.
Now I think it's about 60 or 70% Jewish, but and the population's growing a lot.
Yeah.
But it was a nice place. It was safe. It's the type of town you didn't have to really lock your doors. And
Dad played basketball?
Yeah, my dad had played basketball at DePaul University in the late 30s and early 40s, and they actually played with George Mike, and a famous retired NBA player that played in the 40s and 50s. And he went to DePaul Law School. Back then it was like, you know, in a handshake you'd get kind of a scholarship to college and law school. I mean, he lived at home, but
You then went to Duke. Was that because of basketball? Because you're a tall guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I was looking for a school with good academics and basketball, and like Duke, my backdoor neighbor actually went to University of North Carolina on a baseball scholarship, Mike McLaughlin. I think he was maybe one of their first full scholarship players, and you know, he really liked the area, and my minister and his wife had gone to Duke, and their son, which is 3 years ahead of me in high school, had gone to Duke. And so I was very interested.
Did you have any professional aspirations at that time?
Not really that much. I was actually as a pre-med student, and then my pre-med career ended with organic chemistry in the sophomore year.
So many
and,
do.
My senior year, I got drafted, you know, low round, and for a year or two, I bounced around trying out for some pro teams. I have a friend of mine called me a vagabond hoopster. I got cut my first year out of school from the New York Nets and joined a touring basketball team overseas of kind of college players that hadn't made the pros, and went as far as the Philippines for a 4-game set with the Philippines, and we're in, you know, Hong Kong and India and Sri Lanka. It was kind of interesting, and then ended up, and it was about 2 months I was on the tour.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I don't want you to leave Duke just yet, because there was at least one game where you figured kind of heavily, and it was a Duke-UNC game.
Well, my junior year, yeah, I hadn't really been playing much. You know, back up, get in occasionally, and my good friend Mike Lewis, who was an All-American Duke, and he played in the pros several years, got in foul trouble, and missed a lot of the game. I got in the first half for a little bit, and I think I might have scored 3 points. And then, you know, later in the second half, he fouled out, you know, despite having 18 points and 18 rebounds at that point. And
or maybe that's why he fouled out.
Well, the game ended up going into triple overtime, and we ended up winning, I think, by a point.
You scored a few points in that game.
Well, I had 16 points.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, you know, it was more than I had in any game, but I hadn't really played too much, so.
Well,
it was fun beating Carolina.
I just lost half my audience now, but Fred, it was good to hear that story. And not only did you play a role in that game, but then you played at UCLA when that player we would come to know as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was playing there.
Well, that was kind of interesting. That was my sophomore year. My freshman year, freshmen weren't eligible back then in the 60s, and UCLA came and played the varsity my freshman year, and they were coming off, I believe, a national championship, and they won in 64 and 65, and Duke won both games. We played a preliminary game. The freshmen, we played Southwood Military Academy that had the late, great Pete Maravich on the team.
Uh-huh.
And so we beat them pretty handily, and then the next year we go out and Lou Alcindor, who is now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, was star, and we just got crushed. We played a Friday and Saturday. You know, the year before we had two, we played a game in Durham and then played a game in Charlotte. And then we went out there my sophomore year, and I actually didn't get in either game, but it was a beating. It was fun visiting Southern California. We got to Disney World, and it was beautiful in Westwood. I really liked the Los Angeles area, and but the games didn't work out too well.
Talk about then touring, in on these touring teams as you're sort of waiting to get into the pros. What was that like? What are you at that point dreaming about a professional career, thinking about how you can make it in the pros, and that you're going to parlay this kind of travel around the world into that?
Right. Well, that was to keep playing. Yeah. I hadn't really thought too much about the pros until I got drafted and had a chance, and when I tried out and didn't make it, and then got in this touring team, which was kind of just interesting. And there was actually an article in Sports Illustrated called "The Tour." A guy by the name of Jim McGregor, who'd coached in college, he'd recruit players for this tour, and then he'd try to place them. And a lot of the players went on to play in Europe, and I really didn't have an interest in playing in Europe. Looking back, I kind of wish maybe I'd done it, because I have a couple of friends who played over there in several years. And But then I came back to the States and, tried again. Then I got in law school at DePaul in the fall of 71. So
tell me more about that. Going to law school, again, at one point you're thinking about becoming a doctor. I think you said it was organic chemistry that ended that dream. And then now you're going back to law school. What were you thinking about yourself? Did you have a plan for what kind of law you wanted?
Really didn't have a real big plan, but I actually stayed, lived with my parents. They had moved down to Chicago, and they were nice enough to let me live with them. And I went to DePaul Law School, which is about a mile and a half or so away, and I could walk, and if the weather wasn't too bad.
I think they call that July.
But after about half a year in law school up there, I really don't like the cold weather. I mean, I like the Chicago area, and I had decided that I would try to come back to North Carolina. I still wasn't sure exactly what type of law I'd want to do, but I would go over to the federal building, which was close to where my law school was, and I'd watch criminal cases, and I'd see some of the best trial lawyers in the country, and it was really fascinating watching some of the cases. And then, interestingly enough, my father had gone to some bar luncheon and sat next to the head public defender and mentioned that I was going to DePaul Law School, and so Jim Doherty was the head public defender. He said, well, send your son by. And so I went by, and my last semester in law school, I interned with the public defender in Chicago and got involved in some jury trials, maybe some jury questioning some jurors. I didn't actually handle any witnesses, but it was fun. We'd have a jury trial, and then, while the jury was deliberating, the defense lawyers and prosecutors would go out with the judge and go to a bar across the street and have a couple pops,
And then, wow, how a bill becomes law. So tell me more about that, though, because the public defender's office, you said, you interned with this office, but that's a relatively new idea in American jurisprudence, right? The public defender.
Well, in North Carolina, it started in 1970, but it started earlier. I think in Chicago, it might have started in the late 50s, and Jim Doherty, who was the head public defender then, had actually been involved in a famous case, Richard Speck, who was a serial killer in the late 50s. The public defender in Chicago was going pretty strongly then. They had what they call different branches around the county. And I was in the downtown branch. It was in the Civic Center.
But tell us about the theory and why this is a sort of in that way a late development, something that develops in the 1950s in America, maybe a little bit earlier. But the idea of an office of public defender that would be publicly supported, right?
Right. It would be. Well, in 1963, you had the Gideon case that mandated representation for people that couldn't afford a lawyer, and I think the idea is that you get there's a lot of indigent people, and you want to get some specialization. And you get the public defender, and these people on the public defender staff, they're in court all the time. They know the judges. They know the prosecutors. They specialize in it. And you're going into public defender work. You know you're not going to get rich, but you have to have a passion for indigent defense. And so that's, I think, the basis of it. And
because up until then, I mean, lawyers, and I don't really know how far back this goes, but the idea of pro bono work, that lawyers were, I think, expected as professionals to do some of this kind of work pro bono for free to help indigent clients before the institution of a public defender's office. Were they not? Or did
yeah,
not go
they were.
Before?
Yeah, sure. That's the way it worked. And in some places, the judges would say, listen, you're going to take this case. And in North Carolina, before the public defender system, they'd give fees, but it was, you know, sometimes the judges, let's say, wouldn't be that generous with the fees. Mm-hmm. People had gotten a big case. And so that discouraged maybe some lawyers who are trying to make a living.
Right. I mean, you really do have to do some math here on how long this case is going to take me, how much I'm getting paid, what I'm going to lose while I'm working on this case.
Exactly, yeah.
That made it difficult. So then the public defender, and as you say, in North Carolina, this was, well, talk about how you came, because you talked about interning there in the Chicago
right,
area.
So I really liked it. And so I wanted to come back to North Carolina, and I wanted to go with the public defender's office. At the time, there were only three offices in the state, Fayetteville, in Greensboro, Guilford County, and then Asheville. And I wasn't interested in going up to Asheville, and so I interviewed with these other two offices. And luckily, there was an opening in the Guilford County office. The public defender system had started January 1st of 1970. I think the Fayetteville and Guilford County, Cumberland County and Guilford County offices had opened then. And so
this was in some ways new territory for them, right? I mean, the idea that they were going to specialize in this kind of
right. I think it started in North Carolina as sort of a pilot project. Mm-hmm. And now we're at 50 years, and there's going to be a 50-year sort of celebration coming up the next year. Indigent Defense Services, who oversees it, the public defender's offices and all indigent defense is doing a really outstanding job of, you know, they coordinate it. Their office is right up the street here. I think it's 321 Main Street.
Interesting that not in Wake County and not in Durham County. You mentioned Asheville, Fayetteville, and Guilford, but not in the other two.
Well, I think in some of the areas there was resistance from the private lawyers who were getting court appointed. Now we call that the private assigned counsel.
Yeah.
In public defender districts, the public defenders can't take all the cases. There'll be conflicts. So you have a panel of lawyers who'll take cases. But in some of the areas that don't have a public defender office, they have private assigned counsel, and the folks at Indigent Defense Services oversee that, and all Indigent Defense Services for, you know, Department of Social Services cases, and so sometimes it's tough to get lawyers. You know, they get in the list, they don't get paid a real great amount per hour, and that's what they're trying to.
Right.
To raise that, to get the quality of a lawyer. But, in the bigger cities, now that I think there are 16 or 17 public defender offices around the state.
What was the perception of the public defender? Again, you say relatively new in Guilford County. In those early days, how was it perceived?
I don't think the perception was nearly as good as it is now. And Wally Harrelson, who was the original public defender and was nice enough to hire me, and I hung on by my fingernails till he unfortunately died in 2011. But you serve at the pleasure of the head public defender. But, Wally even years ago said, well, the public defender is kind of the redheaded stepchild of the legal system. But now it's, it's the quality of representation is just really tremendous. I mean, people are really interested, a lot of people. We've had, when I was with the public defender in Guilford County, we'd maybe have an opening or two, and we get as many as 150 or 200 people apply, and cut it down to maybe 10 wow. or 20 people for interviews.
Well, tell me about what makes it attractive to them and to you, because I'm guessing that maybe I'm wrong about this too, because I really don't know what the fees are or what the salary is, but I'm guessing you might be able to make more in private practice.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody in private practice could make a lot more.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side of the coin, there's a lot of law schools. One of them closed. We had, at one point, had seven law schools here, but the Charlotte closed. So there's a lot of young lawyers coming out, and I think a lot of them, it's tough. They have a tough time scratching out a living. And so one thing about public defender office, you're going to be on a salary. And one of the beauties about being with a public defender is it's like I feel like the pure practice of law. I mean, you're representing people, and you don't have to worry about a fee. I heard somebody one time mention that a private lawyer can talk to their client and say, look, I can worry about my fee or your case, not both. With a public defender, we get the support, like I said, of Indigent Defense Services. You have the facilities and the equipment. You don't have to worry about running an office. You have to worry about representing your client. Now, on the other side of the coin, sometimes the caseload is pretty heavy, and you have to figure out the most efficient way to be organized to handle the caseload.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the caseload can be heavy, particularly when we see the way our legal system works with regard to people of lower means. It is been called by many a highly unfair system that targets people of lower wealth, meaning there's more of them in the system. When you talk about having to be judicious, I mean, there might be a tendency to take a plea. Let's get through this. We got too many cases. I can't afford to take you all to court.
Well, yeah, that's a real problem. And sometimes people come up on what's called first appearance, and before they even get a lawyer, a judge might say, well, you're in there, like one day, if you plead guilty, I'll give you time served. Well, that could really hurt somebody down the road, just having a record.
Yeah, like especially if they didn't do it. I mean, that's what
you're
saying.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Yeah. A lot of times people, will go ahead and do that. So So it's very important to get lawyers in the system as early as possible. And that's one thing about the public defender. You're not worried about getting a fee. So if you have to try a case in district court, and let's say it goes bad, you're convicted, North Carolina has a two-tier system. You can appeal for what's called a trial de novo or a new trial in superior court. Private lawyers can have to charge a big fee to go up, but in the public defender office, if something goes bad in district court, you can appeal. Of course, the flip side is if you get convicted in district court and maybe you get a small fine, if you appeal and are found guilty in superior court, it could be
worse.
Well, yeah. you have to just look at those factors.
Now, I understand that when you first took this job, you thought you were going to take it for just a couple of years. Is that right?
Yeah, I really thought maybe I'd do it for two or three or four years. And like I tell people, last September was, 45 years, and I'm thinking of making it a career. But I just enjoyed it. Wally Harrelson was a great, great boss. And, his philosophy was he'd try to hire good people and, let you try your cases and handle your cases.
I hear that people admire you, other lawyers admire you for the number of cases that you actually took to trial. And this may not sound, remarkable if you're not a lawyer, but the fact is it is easier to do a plea. And you apparently like the challenge of going to court. And if you thought you had a better chance in court, that's where we're going.
I did try a lot of cases. I didn't have a particularly great record. I'd win some, but I think I tried maybe about 325 jury trials over the years. The last maybe seven or eight, I really didn't try too many. I was more supervisory. I could have handled them being the head public defender, but there aren't as many cases tried as there used to be. And I felt if I took a case, that'd deprive somebody else of doing it. But I could have picked and choose any cases I wanted, but
So what was it about the job that made you stay after initially you thought maybe you weren't going to stay as long?
Well, I just really enjoyed it. I enjoyed representing people, like the competition of getting in court and sometimes, getting in these trials. Of course, there is a small percentage of trials. As I said, there's less now than there used to be. One time in the late 70s, I had four felony jury trials in 1 week. We only had Superior Court 1 week a month in High Point. But now, because of the structured sentencing and different factors, there really aren't as many cases tried. But I enjoyed representing people, and people were usually pretty appreciative. I'd say in 45 years, I maybe only had a handful of people that, were really kind of jerks, but I think people are pretty appreciative. And when I was head public defender for about 8 years, I enjoyed getting letters from people and calls saying, gee, so-and-so did a great job on the case. I appreciate the work they did. And, I got a letter from a juror one time and just talking about what a great job. So it's really nice to see the good work that the folks in the office are doing.
I'll tell you what, we'll talk a little bit more about how that work is done when my conversation with Fred Lynn continues, the newly retired chief public defender for Guilford County after 45 years in the office, not always as chief, but certainly in that office for 45 years, now retired. And our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Fred Lynn today, newly retired chief public defender for Guilford County. Spent 45 years serving that community. I want to get into the life of an attorney, particularly in that area, a public defender. I said earlier there is a perception that people who are poor have a more difficult time, more challenges within the legal system, that it's stacked against them. You've had a ringside seat. What's your sense of what it's like to be poor in our legal system?
That was tough because a lot of the people are poor. Plus, a lot of our clients have mental health problems, and they have chance alcohol or drug abuse problems. So you have to look at all those combinations, and you have to get expert witnesses sometimes. You have to get evaluations. There's all kinds of paperwork you have to do to get somebody sent off to an evaluation, maybe at Dick's, but now Central Regional Hospital. Right. But I think the lawyers now are really attuned to that, and they really look at somebody's mental status and if they need some treatment for drug or alcohol abuse or to be sent off for an evaluation and then go from there. And they're the facilities to have it done, but it takes some digging and work, and sometimes you have to dig around for medical records and file motions in court.
And what about the expense and all that? I mean, it's interesting to think about, a pro bono attorney, somebody is taking a case and then is faced with having to do all this extra work, or maybe hire an investigator. And here's where the difference is, right? If I've got money, I say, hire that investigator. Let's bring that into the trial. Can you do all that?
Well, within reason. And that's the nice thing. I was talking about Indigent Defense Services, which is now part of AOC, but Tom Maher has been the executive director. He was a prominent criminal defense lawyer since, I think, 2009 or 2010. And he oversees all these areas. There's a capital defender for capital defense, juvenile defender for juvenile defense, parent representation. And he's assisted by Susan Brooks, who was accomplished lawyer, public defender in Florida before she came up here, went to Harvard Law School, knows a lot about it and very supportive. So they're very supportive, and they help out the public defender offices and if we have any issues. But if somebody needs funds, for example, for an investigator, you're entitled to apply for it. And within reason, you can get money for that. Or if you need an expert witness, you ask for funds for a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And so those funds can be available, but the lawyer needs to make the effort to make the motion to get the funds for that.
Right.
If you have a private client, they have the funds, it's a little easier. But
right.
if you're a public defender or court-appointed private assigned counsel, then
you have to make
the request. And, everything is not going to be approved. But if it's reasonable, for example, in the capital cases, sometimes it's just thousands and thousands of dollars for mitigation experts and mental health experts. Some of these cases are really tough, but they're good results. There's very good results that have been achieved.
Yeah, you would hope that justice is served in every case. What about jury selection? Do you have to work on preconceptions about being defended by a public defender, about being indigent? Is that something you look for in juries and jury selection?
Well, I used to not really want to advertise that I was with the public defender's office. Some people like to do it, unless it was like drug trafficking or something. And then, you say, I'm with a public defender, and they maybe think, this guy, how can he be a drug trafficker if he can't even afford a lawyer? But, some judges might not let you say you're a public defender, or some will. It just depends. But, if they know you're with public defender's office, it doesn't necessarily, affect you. But
well, take us behind the scenes. For any good lawyer, how do you figure out whether you've got the right juror or the wrong juror?
Well, that's a real art. There's a real art to picking jurors, and you have to ask the questions. You have to ask questions and look at the body language and try to figure out, is this person telling the truth? You might ask them about will we hold it against my client if they don't testify, that type of thing, and just kind of see what the reaction is, especially if your client's not going to testify. But, on the other side of the coin, you might say, well, then on the other side of the coin, if my client does testify, will you hold that against him because you think he has a weak case and needs to testify? So you need to ask those questions and ask the jurors if they have any ties with law enforcement, and if the law enforcement credibility is going to be an issue.
Because learning to read the body language has to be important, because everybody knows the right answer, right? We all
exactly
know the right.
Well,
of course,
yeah.
I wouldn't. Just look at the facts. I won't look at anything else. So you got to figure out, what
and
do they mean?
And sometimes the judges will step in. The judges will say, you can be fair, can't you, Mr. Stacio? you won't hold it against
me. Yeah.
You'll listen to my instructions. And so sometimes it's
oh my goodness.
The judges will step in as hard. But what can happen is a lawyer in a regular case, not a capital case, will get 6 peremptory challenges. So you can excuse a juror for anything except race or gender or religion, that type of thing.
Well, what about you? You mentioned putting your defendant or your client on the stand or not. How do you make that choice?
Well, that's always a real tough decision. I mean, you have to talk to them and spend a lot of time and prepare. And depending on what type of case it is, sometimes it's necessary. If you're going to raise self-defense, you don't always have to put somebody on the stand if you raise self-defense, but sometimes it's necessary. And, you know, the case can get out of control if you put a client on the witness stand, you know, unless you're really prepared. I heard somebody talk about a lawyer in Durham, Dog Brogdon. I never met him, but I heard that he made the statement he didn't put his client in the witness stand because it would remove even the unreasonable doubt. So you just have to be careful because sometimes a case will be in good shape and, you know, you put your client on the witness stand that can go bad or... So it's just, and sometimes you don't make the decision until the, till after all the evidence is in.
What about how have things changed over 45 years in that office?
Well, I think first of all, it's a lot bigger. When I first came, I went to our High Point office. We're the only county in the state that has 2 sitting superior courts, High Point and Greensboro. And I was in our High Point office for about 5.5 years, commuting from Greensboro for all but 1 year. And then I got transferred to the Greensboro office. But, the offices are bigger. And as I was talking about, there's more specialization. I mean, I talked about Indigent Defense Services. They have a whole section on forensic sciences, a woman by the name of Sarah Olson. It's a website. And they can, you know, if somebody has, for example, a DNA, you can get an expert. Years ago, the DNA wasn't there. They just have type O blood type, and there is kind of iffy science.
Yeah.
And, you might not have the experts that could handle it, but now there's so many experts.
And what about the training? I mean, from the time you went in, again, almost a brand new office in the state of North Carolina, how has training changed for public defenders?
Well, it's gotten a lot more specialized and intense. When I started out in 1974, it was the first public defender conference, and we met down Moorhead City, and I think there were maybe 14 or 16 people, and including Mary Ann Talley, who is one of the top capital defense lawyers in the state. She's now a Superior Court judge in Cumberland County, but she had started with a public defender in Cumberland when I started in Guilford. But there were maybe 16 people we met in the motel room down at the Islander Motel. Now there's 250 to 300 people at our conferences, but besides that, there's specialized training. If somebody comes into an office, they have the School of Government, and Indigent Defense Services works closely with the School of Government. It used to be called the Institute of Government. And they've always been involved in public defender conferences, but they have training for misdemeanor new people. They have felony training. They have high-level felony training. They have juvenile training. They have a trial school, and they have that once a year in the summer, and lawyers from usually it's public defender offices will take a case they have that looks like it's going to go to trial, and they'll take that case, and it has to be sort of a hard case, and they'll go through it. They'll have smaller groups of 5 or 6, and
so they're taking a live case.
And they'll go through the jury selection, they'll go through the cross examination, the direct examination, the closing argument. All the lawyers will sign a confidentiality agreement. There's a fellow in the Guilford County office, Dave Clark, who's been doing it for 12 years, and he'll come back and say, "Well, yeah, I get the call from somebody that said, yeah, we got a not guilty verdict." But the people at the School of Government, you have John Rubin and Phil Dixon and Jeff Welty and Jessica Smith and Jamie Markham. They work closely with Indigent Defense Services, and they work up some specialized training, and it's really excellent training, and much better than, 30 or 40 years ago.
How has the whole process changed, not just the public defender's office, but I'm talking about in jurisprudence in particular, in general, police work. I remember you were talking at one point about lineups and sort of how the identifying potential defendants or potential perpetrators from photos has changed, right?
It has. I don't know if it might have been... 7 or 8 years ago in North Carolina, a law came in to have a procedure for lineups. And it used to be the police would take maybe a big page and put 6 or 7 or 8 photographs on a page and show it to somebody, somebody that's been a victim, and say, well, you know, can you pick out the person? And, you know, the problem with that is they're kind of going for the more relative closest thing.
And that's interesting. I mean, you would think, but what you're saying here is that just the way the human mind works, I'm going to pick somebody from that group who looks most like the person who did it, when really you've been asked, yes or no.
Exactly. And now they have it where the procedure is you get a stack of photographs and you try to get somebody administering this that doesn't know who the suspect is. And they tell the person, the picture of the suspect may or may not be in here. So they'll have a pile, you know, 7, 8, 10 photographs, and they'll take one photograph and they'll show it to them and they'll say, just look at this. Yeah. And so is this the person? You know, so it's not like they're comparing and the one that looks the more, you know, and they say, and then they just take as long as you want and they'll set it down and then, you know, they'll show another photograph. So that North Carolina is very progressive in that aspect, because I'm not sure that many states have that law.
Well, I wonder how it's changed for you. It comes as no surprise to me that you can't really have a process that's going to get you to the truth using objectivity and reason, because I, for a long time, had my doubts about human reason and how much it applies to decision making. And thank goodness for Dan Ariely, who's a psychologist and researcher at Duke, who's more or less demonstrated how irrational we are. But I wonder for you, who's in the process, and the point is, we're going to try to get to the truth, and we've developed this process, and we've done it in good faith. Your sense of whether this process can actually get you to the truth, or whether there's just, we don't account for subjectivity enough.
Well, that's probably true. One thing, Frank, that's come into use in a lot of places is the body cam, and so that can be very useful. Mm-hmm. Now in Guilford County they have it, and sometimes there's hours of body cam, so the lawyers in our office will look at it, or have interns. We have the office I used to be with has a very good intern program, and sometimes you look through those hours of, and it doesn't always have to be hours, but you look through the video cams. And there's a difference in what the police report said. So there's been a lot of cases that have been dismissed. And I think it really keeps the law enforcement honest, because it shows exactly what's said, and sometimes different than what the officers say. And another point on that is another law that North Carolina has put in is that for taping of interviews with suspects the last 7 or 8 years. So now, when you have purported confessions, you can see, you know, what's said and, you know, what the officers say. And that's very helpful, because sometimes, as we all know, sometimes a confession isn't worth the paper it's written on. Right. You know, I mean, and sometimes it is, but...
We know in way too many cases, somebody who looks at the deck and how it's stacked against them says, I can take a deal here and just get this over with. You know, we certainly saw that with... Central Park and you know, that story. Well, let's talk about some of the high media, high profile cases that have come to the attention of the public. You know, I'm thinking about that 2015 Netflix series called Making a Murder, which raised concerns about the public defender's office and, again, our jurisprudence system. What did you watch any of that? And
I probably watched about 6 or 7 of the 10 episodes, and I got pretty upset with the I think it was a court appointed lawyer that represented the co-defendant. I mean, it wasn't representation. I don't know if he wanted to curry favor with the district attorney or what, but he just didn't do anything for the young guy that had all kinds of problems. I think that person's case had been overturned, I think.
Is it the series that followed the uncle and nephew who are convicted of murder?
The people that represented the uncle, I think, you know, they were pretty qualified lawyers. I think did a pretty good job and, you know, did the research, but the other fellow, and so, you know, there are areas where you just don't have the lawyers that are dedicated to it. That sometimes they're doing it because they need the business.
Yeah. Well, talk more about that. Maybe your sense of how it is nationally, and maybe how uneven this kind of role is across the country.
Well, in some states, it's really bad. Frank, North Carolina is pretty lucky. I mean, we could use more funding. Several years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, the legislature chopped off about $10 or $12 million from Indigent Defense Services. But in some of these states, like Louisiana and Mississippi, they might force somebody to do a capital case for, you know, $2,000 or something. I mean, it's really bad. And there's been lawsuits. I think there's a lawsuit in New Orleans now. I mean, you know, the public defenders. Just have too many cases. They can't do it. In North Carolina, which is nice, if a public defender's office gets too many cases, just can't handle it. There's a safety valve where they can farm out the cases and have private assigned counsel take the cases. I mean, you don't want to do that unless you have to. But, I mean, you know, there's only a certain number of cases you can effectively represent people on.
So what are you going to do next? Retired after 45 years? What's next?
Well, I'm going to try to keep up my law license, not practice, but I still enjoy going to legal meetings. And I have a daughter who just had her fourth child, lives out in Arizona. I'm going to go out there. And another daughter lives in Oakland, California. And so probably be out there for a while. And still like to be headquartered in North Carolina. I love North Carolina. It's a great state. And I like to keep up with the legal community. And
Well, pleasure to talk with you. Don't ever leave us.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I appreciate your show. You're one of my favorites.
You're very kind. Fred Lind, retired chief public defender of Guilford County, former Duke player, famous for that 1968 basketball game that went into triple overtime. Duke won. Now I've lost, you know, another half of my audience, but I did it because that was the truth, and I told it on the State of Things. You can find out more about Fred at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.